Okay, let's start up again. Let's start up again. Okay, let me just run a couple questions by you. To make sure you understand something. I'll give you a personal example. My first marathon in San Diego. I didn't take any fluids the first 20 miles. None. Zip. I was feeling good. Felt good, and then I hit what they call the wall. That means zip glycogen in any body, part of your body. And it's like you're walking in slow motion. Okay, and it was a pretty warm day that day. And so I was losing a lot of sweat. Okay. So what is the tonicity of sweat, please? It's a hypotonic. Is it pure water, or does it have salt in it? So it's a hypotonic salt solution. Is that correct? Okay. Now, this didn't actually happen to me from this point on, but let's say it did. The first part was correct. Okay? I did finish the race. I walked in, and what do you think was the impetus for that? Was it the old man that ran by me? No. Was it the teenage that ran by me? No. So what was it that was able to get me the last 6 miles to the finishing line when I was in a state of complete hypovolemic shock? A woman ran by me. That is true. You can show she beat me. I said, oh, she do it, I can do it. You know, I finished in 3 hours and 30 minutes, and I walked the rest of the way from 20 miles to the other 6 miles. So you can imagine how fast I was running the first 20. What an idiot. Okay, so let's say I collapsed. You do a tilt test on me. I'm 100 over 80 lying down with a pulse of 120. You sit me up, I get a little woozy. I'm now 70 over 60, 150 pulse. Am I hypovolemic from my sweating? Yes or no? What's your first step in management? What are you going to infuse into me? You're going to stick an IV in me. What are you going to give me to get my blood pressure up? Normal saline. Okay, so you put a liter in, I'm still showing no signs. You put another liter in, my blood pressure is now normal. But I still have signs of volume depletion, dry mouth and stuff like that. I'm still not completely together. Okay? And so what are you going to hang up now on me? Okay, you got my blood pressure stabilized. What did you say the tonicity of my fluid was that I was losing? Hypotonic salt solution. So what are you going to hang up on me as an IV? Hypotonic salt solution. Could you give me an example? You're going to give me 5% dextrose in water? No, why? Because there's no salt in it. Are you going to give me half normal saline? Yes, you are. That's correct. So what's the maxim of fluid therapy when you lose something? Give the patient what they lost. If I lost a hypotonic salt solution, that's what you give me. But if I'm hypovolemic, what's the first thing you always start with? Normal saline. I'll give you another example. Diabetic ketoacidosis. Do you have osmotic diuresis going on? Yes or no? What did I say was the tonicity of the fluid that occurs, that you lose in your urine when you have excess glucose in it? You have hypotonic fluid. A little bit more water than salt. Agreed? Okay, so anyone that's taken care of a DKA patient knows when they take a blood pressure on them, they are severely hypovolemic, and that's the thing that kills them. The high glucose is nothing. Nothing. Your first step in management is volume depletion. So they all have hypovolemia. Some of them are in hypovolemic shock from all that salt and water loss. So what's your first step in managing a patient with diabetic ketoacidosis? Normal saline. You put insulin in? No, that's worthless. You just give them normal saline. What's the purpose? Make them normal tensive. It may take liters. Usually you're out 6 to 8 liters of fluid when you have diabetic ketoacidosis. You may take 6, 7 liters of isotonic saline before that blood pressure starts stabilizing. Okay, now I'm feeling better. I've still got my 1,000 milligrams percent glucose, but volume-wise, I'm fine now. Now what are you going to do? What am I losing in my urine, guys? More water than salt. What are you going to hang up now on me and put insulin into it? Normal saline? What am I losing in my urine, guys? Hypotonic salt. What are you going to hang up on me? Half normal saline, and what are you going to put into it? glucose. I mean insulin. That's right. So the maxim is whenever you have you're hypovolemic, what's your first step in the management of the patient? Normal saline to get the blood pressure normal. Then you can decide what if you still need to give IV fluids, then you have to decide, well, what caused the hypovolemia? Was it sweating? Then you give me a hypotonic salt solution. Was it diarrhea and I'm an adult? Well, then I just stay with the normal saline because that's an isotonic salt that I'm losing. You understand? Let's say you had a patient with diabetes insipidus, okay, and for some reason you didn't know they had it and they went through a long surgery and they didn't have, okay, they probably ended up with a 160 serum sodium and all that stuff, okay, and they get out of surgery, you notice they got a 165 serum sodium, okay, and then you find out eventually that the patient has diabetes insipidus. How would you treat that? Let's say the blood pressure, let's say the patient's blood pressure and everything's stable and the patient is lucid. What would you want to give them? Water. Well, let's say you couldn't, it was just too dangerous to do it. They could aspirate it after surgery. What would you give them? What are they losing, guys? Pure water. What are you going to give them? Water. IV. And so what are you going to probably put in the water? You're probably going to make it what? 5% dextrose in water. Okay. There's nobody that's just going to give them pure water because when that patient looks at their bill, okay, and sees that they were given pure water IV, you know, $35, you know, they're saying, hey, I could have drank that, buddy. And so he had 5% dextrose and water. Whoa, I got something important. No, all you did was get 50 grams of glucose. Okay, they just give that to give you little carbs. So basically, you give the patient, if they have to get an IV and they have diabetes insipidus because they lost pure water, give them something close to pure water. 5% dextrose of water is close enough. You're certainly not going to give them half normal saline because they haven't lost salt. They're going to salt overload them. Okay, that's just, we're getting off the concept for part one. It's more part two-ish, but let's just stop there at that point. Okay, shock. Okay, we have four kinds of shock. Part two deals with neurogenic, and so we're not going to deal with that, usually in the context of spinal cord injuries. And that's when you really got to know how to diagnose neurogenic shock. Now, we went through hypovolemic shock, and you brought up a couple things, blood loss. It could be diarrhea, adult or kid. Anytime you lose salt, you can end up in hypovolemic shock. Okay, that's basically it. Now, cardiogenic shock is most commonly due to a myocardial infarction. You all knew that. And then septic shock is most commonly due to E. coli. That's actually the most common cause of sepsis in a hospital. And where do you think it's coming from? An indwelling urinary catheter. It's not staph aureus. Most people would say when you're in a hospital and you get septicemia, that's most commonly staph aureus from an IV. No, E. coli beats it. Hands down. Okay, so the most common cause of septic shock is E. coli. Now, you had microbiology, and what makes a gram-negative organism, please? Endotoxins. Endotoxins in the cell wall is a lipopolysaccharide. So gram-negatives have lipid in their cell wall, gram-positives don't. What is that lipid in the cell wall of a gram-negative? Endotoxins. So a gram-negative organism is gram-negative because of endotoxins in its cell wall. And so if you have an E. coli sepsis, you're going to have a big-time problem because you're going to be in what is called septic shock. Now, you can get it from gram-positives. Gram-positives have toxins in their wall, too, but it's way more common with gram-negatives, specifically E. coli, big-time, big-time. All right, let's take the standard hypovolemic and cardiogenic shock, okay? What's my skin going to feel like? Talk to me. Cold and clammy. Why? Basal constriction of my peripheral vessels. By who? Just go through what we just went through. What's my EABV, stroke volume, cardiac output? Decrease. What did I say was the main? Catecholamines and angiotensin II and all those other things are going to constrict my vessels in my skin and redirect the blood flow to more important organs in my body, like brain and kidney. So I have cold, clammy skin. What's my blood pressure? It's decreased. What's my pulse? It's increased. Very good. That's, you see, in classic hypovolemic or cardiogenic shock. Not so septic shock. That's unfortunate that you haven't had Passover for cardiovascular, because he would have taught you Poiseuille's law, which is a concept that teaches you about your peripheral resistance arterioles, which control your diastolic blood pressure. Poiseuille's law states that total peripheral resistance, referring to your arterioles, is equal to, and I'm going to make this real simple because this is all you really need to know for boards, viscosity of blood in the numerator divided by the radius of the vessel to the fourth power. That's all you have to know about Poiseuille's law. So one simple question on boards was, what is the main factor controlling total peripheral resistance? Now that's a no-brainer. It's the radius to the fourth power, obviously. Okay? That's the main thing because it's to the fourth stinking power. Viscosity isn't to the fourth power. What controls the viscosity in your blood, guys? Your hemoglobin. And so if you're anemic, what's the viscosity of your blood? Decreased. If you have polycythemia, what's the viscosity of your blood? There you go. So anemia, it's decreased. Polycythemia, it's increased. Okay, so what happens to your total peripheral resistance when you're anemic? It decreases because it's in the numerator. When you have polycythemia, what happens to your total peripheral resistance? It increases. Pretty simple so far, yes? Okay. Now, when you have septic shock, guys, you release endotoxins, they do horrible things. First of all, they activate the alternative complement system and cause eventually the release of C3A and C5A. Does that mean anything to you? What are they? They're anaphylotoxins. So what are they going to stimulate directly? The mast cells to release what, please? Histamine. What did the histamine do, please? Vasodilatation of what? Arterioles. You mean those peripheral resistance arterioles? One and the same. So if the blood flow is increased through peripheral resistance arterioles, what's your skin feel like? Warm. Just like it did in acute inflammation. Not cold and clammy, because they were constricted vessels. These are dilated. But also, endotoxins damage your endothelial cells. Anybody knows some kind of chemical in your endothelial cells that is a potent vasodilator? I know two. Nitric oxide's one of them, and another one's prostacycline, PGI2. So we have about two or three vasodilators out there that are causing our peripheral resistance arterioles to become dilated big time. So that's to the fourth power. So what happens to total peripheral resistance if we have vasodilated arterioles in this patient in endotoxic shock? Guys, what happens? Talk to me. It decreases. All right. Now, some of you, you're going to need this image to understand what's going to happen. We know that total peripheral resistance arterioles control your diastolic blood pressure because when they're constricted, they can control the amount of blood that remains in your arterial system while your heart is filling up in diastole. Okay, so we know that if they're dilated, what automatically is going to happen to your diastolic blood pressure? It's going to pan out, buddy, big time. Okay. Now, I want us to picture a dam and a big reservoir. Okay, and you know that you can take up the dam gates and you can close the dam the gates. Not that they're dam gates, but they're gates. Okay. I want you to picture a situation where all the gates to a dam that are holding back water in a reservoir are wide open. Anyone ever seen something like that? Okay, that's what happens to your blood when your peripheral resistance arterioles are dilated. It's just the blood just comes gushing through those arterioles, and where's it going to go? Well, into your capillary system, supposedly feeding all your tissues with oxygen. But I'll ask you a question. Would that be a good day to go fishing below a dam, okay, to catch fish when that water's coming out that fast? You think it's going to be something like... You think the fish are actually hanging around to look for food? No, they're getting bonked all over the place. Many of them are going to die because of the turbulent water. So, this is a terrible situation. There's all that blood going by, but do you think the tissue can get any of it? Any oxygen? No, it's going too fast because it isn't a controlled release of blood. It's coming out too fast. Not only that, is it coming back to the heart faster than normal? Is it? Well, sure, if the arterioles are widely dilated, that blood's going right through real fast and coming back to the right side of the heart faster than usual. It's kind of like your kids when you want them outside of the house because you got something to do, and you say, "I want mommy's got something to do. Okay, I want you out there for 30 minutes. Mommy's got something to do." And so you start doing something, and 2 minutes later, they're bored and they're already in the house. So I just told you to stay outside so I can do something. Okay, well, I wanted to come back earlier. Well, that's what the heart's saying when there's blood. It'll look back and say, "Didn't I just pump you out?" "Yes, you did. What are you doing back so fast?" "The arterioles are dilated." So, if blood is coming faster back to the heart, what's the cardiac output in septic shock? It's increased. That's heresy. What's the cardiac output in hypovolemic and cardiogenic shock? Decreased. What's the skin feel like? Cold and clammy. But what's the skin feel like in endotoxic shock? Warm, because the vessels are dilated. So it's a high output failure that occurs in septic shock. With warm skin. Okay? Those are major differences that you even have to know for part one. Part two, you even have to know this also. Okay. Now, I think, and I'm usually reasonably accurate on predicting how these people think that make up this test. I think that Swan-Ganz catheter measurements are perfectly legitimate for part one. I know they're on part two because they basically, a Swan-Ganz stuck into a catheter stuck into the right side of your heart measures all the parameters that you learned about in physiology. And so we should be able to understand what they would show in these different types of shock. So let's introduce you to some of these terms that are seen in a Swan-Ganz catheter. And we'll be able to actually differentiate these forms of shock quite easily. The first thing is cardiac output. Okay, that can be measured by the Swan-Ganz catheter in the right side of your heart very easily. How does it matter? Systemic vascular resistance, that's a calculation that it can make based on things going on in the right heart. That's your total peripheral resistance. That's telling what your arterioles are doing. Isn't that interesting? Systemic vascular resistance measured by a catheter on the right side of your heart can actually tell you what's going on in your arterioles. Cool. It's a calculation. Now, this is a big one. This, and I can assure you, will be on the test. Mixed venous oxygen content. Well, you already know what oxygen content is. It's 1.34 times the hemoglobin times the oxygen saturation plus the PO2. Well, you can measure that in the right atrium with a Swan-Ganz catheter. It is your absolute best test for tissue hypoxia. Lactic acid stinks because there's lots of things that can increase lactic acid and have nothing to do with tissue hypoxia and anaerobic glycolysis. But this one, mixed venous oxygen content, is what's actually returning from your tissue. So I want you to just think about this now, please. What's your cardiac output in hypovolemic and cardiogenic shock, please? It's low. So would you all agree, not only is there not a whole lot of blood, but it's not being pushed ahead with a great amount of force. Yes or no? Okay? So will the tissue have lots of time to extract oxygen from what little blood there is? Yes or no? Yes. So what happens to the mixed venous oxygen content in hypovolemic cardiogenic shock? Decrease very, very low. That is correct. That's just because there's too little of it, and it's going through so slow because there's no force behind pushing it through. And so you get it extracts a lot more oxygen out of it than normal. But here's the one that's a little trickier. What do you think the mixed venous oxygen content is in septic shock when it's going through your tissues like the speed of light? It's high. In other words, tissues, even though there's lots of blood there, can't extract the oxygen out of it. It's going through too fast. Okay? So you know that one. Then you have a thing called pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. We won't tell you how it's done. It's irrelevant. But what is it a measure of? It's a measure of the left ventricular end diastolic volume and pressure. That's cool. So here's a catheter in the right side of the heart that can tell you what the pressure is in your stinking left ventricle. That is cool. All of these things are measured in a Swan-Ganz catheter. All of these things you should be able to use and solve and show and be able to see what the differences are between these types of shots. Now, the next one actually has it all there, but it would be a lot more fun to see if you really understood it for you to tell me. Okay? Now, let's take hypovolemic shock and cardiogenic shock together. What's the cardiac output in both of them, please? Decreased. No problem, yes? What is it in septic shock? Increased. Okay. Very good. Now, let's deal with systemic vascular resistance or total peripheral resistance, which is a measure of what? What the arterioles are doing. Okay, what is the total peripheral resistance in hypovolemic and cardiogenic shock? It's increased. Equate that with something. Vasoconstriction or vasodilatation? Vasoconstriction. Very good. What is the total peripheral resistance in septic shock? Decreased. So we have two differences already between those two dudes. We have an increase in cardiac output, warm skin, and we have a decrease in total peripheral resistance. The other dudes have decreased cardiac output, increased peripheral resistance. Agreed? Mixed venous oxygen content. Hypovolemic and cardiogenic shock, please. Low, very low. Septic shock, high. Okay? So in other words, this is really separating out real easy so far for between septic and hypovolemic and cardiogenic. But we have everything the same so far between hypovolemic and cardiogenic. How do we separate that one out? Okay, pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. What did I say that was a measure of? Left ventricular end diastolic pressure. What would the left ventricular end diastolic pressure be in hypovolemic shock? Low. What would it be in cardiogenic shock? I rest my case. There you go. You don't need to know what it is in endotoxic shock. Actually, it's decreased. Is that easy or what? It is. And does it encompass all the physiologic parameters that you do need to know for part one anyway? Sure does. So if they don't ask specifically this type of thing, that will ask, they'll just use other terms. Well, cardiac output's cardiac output. Instead of using systemic vascular, it might say total peripheral resistance. Okay? And they could say left ventricular pressures, okay, instead of pulmonary capillary. They're still going to ask it, you know that, and because it's all physiologic principles. My second-year students have whipped through this like nothing. No problem at all. They know this. No problem. I know I can get away with this in teaching because my kids are not any sharper than you guys. They have don't have any problems in solving these things. Okay? Neither do you. All right. Now, I'm going to ask you another question. Of all the organs in our body, which one suffers greatest from a decrease in blood pressure? Kidneys. Kidneys do. What part of the kidneys? Medulla. Okay, now some of you wanted to say brain, didn't you? Not a good choice. Why, Circle of Willis? Your cardiac output's decreased. Your Circle of Willis will distribute blood flow to those areas of the brain. Those are the ones with neurons. And keep it going pretty good. Yeah, it's important, the brain, but it's got a Circle of Willis to redistribute blood. No problem if you have cardiogenic shock, hypovolemic in the brain. Okay, at least not for a while. But kidneys? Screwed. Screwed. Big time. So it's the kidneys. Isn't it true, guys, when someone has hypovolemic, cardiogenic shock, septic shock, that oliguria and an increase in BUN and creatinine causes shivers in your body? Because you know that the patient's going into what? Acute tubular necrosis. There you go. And then what are all the nephrologists screaming? Volume, blood flow, renal blood flow, dobutamine, all that kind of stuff that increases renal blood flow. We've got to prevent the patient from going into acute tubular necrosis. Why? They're going to die. That's why. And it looks something like this. Does this look like a normal kidney? Well, what's that? That's the glomerulus. Do these look normal? Well, there's nuclei that are just barely there, but can you see vague outlines of what used to be renal tubules, especially in these right over here? Yes or no? This one's hanging in there. There's always someone that hangs in there. Okay? What type of necrosis is this? Coagulation necrosis. And what do you think is going to happen to these dead renal tubules? They're going to slough off and produce renal tubular casts, which is the pathognomonic cast in the urine in acute tubular necrosis, and block urine flow, producing oliguria. In addition, other things will happen causing a decrease in glomerular filtration rate, voila, you are an ATN. And your chances of survival are zip. So it's the kidneys that are most affected when your cardiac output is decreased. Brain would probably be a close second because those neurons absolutely need oxygen. But thank God for the circle of Willis, it can redistribute blood flow even though it's decreased and get it to those areas and protect them for a while. Heart, you know, also even has a bit of a collateral circulation in it as well. But kidneys, there ain't no collateral circulation. And since the medulla only gets 10% of the cardiac output normally, when the cardiac output's decreased, it gets even less. Did you know that a person with sickle cell trait, not disease, can get kidney disease because of the renal medulla's oxygen tension is low enough to induce sickling? Did you know that? Because if you didn't, then you would have got the question wrong on part one. Young woman, black woman, has normal physical exam except laboratory studies reveal microscopic hematuria. Rest of everything was normal. BUN, creatinine, everything's normal. What's the first step in the workup of the patient was the question. Part one, answer was a sickle cell scrape. Because she probably has sickle cell trait. So no, sickle cell trait is not without its problems. Okay? Because the oxygen tension in the renal medulla is low enough to induce sickling in those peritubular capillaries, which produces microinfarctions in the kidney. Yes, it does. That was on part one, guys. It's on part one. Not two. I'm just on there two. But it's also on part one. So that's a must-know thing. We review that again when we do kidneys, but I just wanted to mention how bad that medulla is in terms of oxygen flow, even normally. And so that's what we worry about most because we don't want to produce coagulation necrosis, which is called acute tubular necrosis. All right. I'm going to teach you acid-base, which includes blood gases. Okay? Not hard. This is what I find that most people don't know too well, and you lose some points on it. Okay? And so I want to go through this. Now, Henderson and Hasselbalch screwed us up pretty bad with their stupid logs. They probably had a Lincoln log set and screwed everything up. Let me tell you why it's stupid. Okay? It's stupid because if you have an acidosis, you'd say, okay, that's an increase in hydrogen ions, pH increased. You have an alkalosis, okay, that's a decrease in hydrogen ions, pH should be decreased. No. It's just the reverse. When you have an acidosis, the pH is decreased. When you have an alkalosis, the pH is increased. And you say, that doesn't make sense. The hydrogen ions are increasing in acidosis and they're decreasing in alkalosis. I don't get it. Logs. Logs is the inverted concept. So you have to think in reverse. That has screwed up American medicine big time. Henderson and Hasselbalch should be thrown out of all books and they should be burned in effigy for causing such massive confusion in students related to acid base. And you know what? There's one other person in some other book that actually wrote that down. I'm even afraid to do it because I don't know if those two dudes are still alive and they're suing. But, man, they have screwed it up royally, big time. So we still have to deal with it. This is the way it should have been written in a non-logarithmic form, and that would make more sense. If we increase PCO2, that would increase pH or the H, and then, you know, you'd have respiratory acidosis. If we decrease this, that would increase that. That makes sense. This, I don't make any sense. So I just narrowed down to this. pH is equal to bicarb over PCO2, and I forget all these 6.1s and logs because they're absolutely worthless. And so if we increase the numerator, bicarb, what should that do to pH? Increase it, and what do we call that? Metabolic alkalosis. We decrease bicarbonate, what does that do to pH? Decrease, what do we call that? Metabolic acidosis. If we increase the PCO2, what would that do to pH? Decrease it, what do we call that? Respiratory acidosis. And if we decrease the PCO2, what does that do to the pH? Increase it, what is that? Respiratory alkalosis. Good! Compensation. Compensation is totally simple, okay? Compensation is the body's attempt to try to maintain a normal pH, which it never does, but it tries. Here's a logical concept. If you want to make the pH roughly stay the normal, assuming you could, and you had metabolic alkalosis, which is an increase in bicarb, then what would you have to do to the denominator to keep the pH roughly normal? You'd have to increase it. And so when you increase the denominator, PCO2, what is that? Respiratory acidosis. So logically, respiratory acidosis has to be the compensation for metabolic alkalosis, right? According to the way the formula is, trying to maintain a normal pH? Yes or no? Now, if you didn't understand that, what's the opposite of metabolic? Respiratory, and what's the opposite of alkalosis? Okay, you can do that. Now, that's not a good way, because that doesn't really mean you understood it. It's just a nice way of memorizing it. It is logical for respiratory acidosis to be the compensation for metabolic alkalosis, because if this is increasing in a numerator, and compensation by definition is the attempt of the body to bring the pH back to normal, then the only thing that would bring that pH back to normal by increasing the numerator is increasing the denominator. And so if we have metabolic acidosis and this is decreased, what do we have to do to the PCO2? We have to blow it off. If we blow it off, what's that called? Respiratory alkalosis, that's the compensation. If we have respiratory acidosis as a primary disease, okay, what are we going to have to do for compensation? We have to raise the numerator, which is bicarbonate metabolic alkalosis. Okay, and if we decrease the denominator as a primary disease, hyperventilation. I'm blowing off CO2. Hypoventilation. You learned this from PASO. What does ventilation mean? Is that an oxygen term or is that a CO2 term? It's a CO2 term, guys. And so if I say I'm hyperventilating, that means I'm blowing off. Hyper means increasing my respiratory rate. That's going to blow off more CO2. I'm going to get respiratory alkalosis. If I'm hypoventilating, that means my respiratory rate's decreased. I'm going to retain CO2. Respiratory acidosis. A lot of students screw that up. I don't get it. I don't get why that would be. It's straightforward. You breathe fast. What do you when you breathe out, what are you getting rid of? CO2. So you lose more. It's decreased. Respiratory alkalosis. If I'm just... What am I not getting rid of? CO2. In fact, I'll give you something funny. I use a steamer for my voice. And so it's a little thing device, and you put water in it, and steam comes up, and I throw in a little bit of Vicks Vapor Rub liquid, and so I get the menthol. And I put my face over this thing, and I breathe it in through my nose, and it helps my vocal cords. That's what opera star singers use. Okay, I do that because I'm using my voice so much. Well, I thought to get more steam, I put a piece of cloth around the thing, this little device like this, so I really get all that steam. All that steam, and I was having a little problem with my breathing. I said, God, I'm having some problem, and I feel like I need oxygen. And so I'm trying to move my gut out from the edge of the table. It's got to be that. And that dawned on me, I was rebreathing my own CO2. Idiot! So I took the stupid thing away. I mean, this regular stick in air, and it has little vents. So I was getting air, and suddenly I felt better. I was rebreathing my own stinking CO2. Now, that'd be a great treatment for respiratory alkalosis, the paper bag thing. Just rebreathe it. That's the best thing to do. When someone has an anxious, you know, hysterical reaction, stick a bag over their stinking head. If you don't like them, plastic. Okay? That'll solve the thing. That'll solve it real fast. Because you rebreathe your CO2. All right. So you got the idea what compensation is. Now I'm going to tell you what uncompensated means, partial compensated. But I will tell you this. Full compensation doesn't exist. You never bring your pH back into the normal range, with one exception, and that's chronic respiratory alkalosis in high-altitude livers, people that live at high altitude. And there's none that live high enough in this country to have that. That would be like Peru and places like that. That's the only case that's known in all the history of medicine where you can bring the pH right back smack into the normal range. And no one's still been able to figure out how that's possible. So normally you bring it close to the normal range, but not into the normal range. So let's do this logically now. Let's talk about the two respiratory conditions, respiratory acidosis and respiratory alkalosis, okay? And let's do it logical. Let's deal with things that deal with CO2. All right? So you already know this already. You know that the respiratory center is where? the medulla oblongata. That's what controls our breathing rate. Yes or no? And then we have the upper airways. If we obstruct them, then we're going to have a problem with getting rid of CO2. So we have to deal with that. Then we have to deal with the chest bellows. What did Tassel call the chest bellows? What's the most important muscle of respiration? Your stinking diaphragms. Because when the diaphragms go down, what happens to your negative intrathoracic pressures? They increase. What does that suck into your lungs? Air. What does it suck into the right side of your heart? Blood. That's why your neck veins collapse on inspiration. The negative vacuum sucks blood and air into your chest, guys. And on expiration, you have a positive intrathoracic pressure. It pushes things out. It helps your left heart push blood out. It also helps get rid of air. You with me? This is just simple respiration stuff. That's your chest bellows, your diaphragms, your intercostals, your sternocleidomastoid, but definitely your diaphragm. And then, of course, you got your lungs. Let's deal with it, okay? Here. All right? If I take a barbiturate or something that depresses my respiratory center, what's going to happen? I'm going to get what? Respiratory what? That's it. Respiratory acidosis. I mean, that's just a no-brainer. Okay, what if I had CNS injury to my medulla? Respiratory acidosis. Okay, so that's easy. No problem. How about respiratory alkalosis? Most common cause is anxiety. Some of you have that. When you take a test, and sometimes you feel strange, you start feeling numb and tingling around your mouth, tips of your fingers start getting numb, you feel kind of twitchy. That's because you're in tetany. Because as you get alkalotic, and I'll teach you why this happens, your ionized calcium level gets lower, and you are getting tetany. And so you really feel weird. You're twitching. Okay, and you're feeling paresthesias, numbness, and tingling. You think you're having a stupid stroke. And what it is that you're breathing too fast. Okay, some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. And just watch your thumb go adduct into your palm. And you say, I didn't want it to do that. Not knowing that that was trousseau sign. Or carpopedal spasm. A sign of tetany. And then maybe you decide to tap over your nerve. I mean, you start twitching like mad. You got yourself a positive spastic sign. I mean, that's all tetany. That's because you're breathing too fast. So anxiety is a thing that can cause the rest. By breathing fast, by being anxious, you usually breathe faster, and you end up with that. Okay, pregnancy. All pregnant women have respiratory alkalosis. You want to know why? Estrogen and progesterone overstimulate the respiratory center. All pregnant women have respiratory alkalosis. A little bit. They say, well, I don't hyperventilate. When I was pregnant, I didn't hyperventilate. Doesn't matter. You had spider angiomas, which are arterial venous fistulas related to your high estrogen. They're in your lungs up the wazoo. You had AV fistulas in there. And so you clear more CO2 per breath than a non-pregnant woman. Well, the AV fistulas go away after you deliver your baby. You got something going on in your lungs you don't believe when you're pregnant. And sometimes you see those little spider angiomas on your skin. You say, oh my God, what's this? I have cirrhosis. No, you don't. You are pregnante. That means pregnant in Greek. All right. All right. All right, endotoxins overstimulate the system. So all patients in endotoxic shock have respiratory alkalosis. And since they're in shock, you tell me what else they have. Are they in anaerobic metabolism, yes or no? Yes, so what else do they have? Metabolic acidosis. Due to what? Lactic acid, there you go. So they have one teaspoonful of respiratory alkalosis because endotoxins overstimulate it, all right? Let's just do a cooking class. Some of you understand that. Here's one teaspoon of respiratory alkalosis from the endotoxin overstimulating your system, and one teaspoon of metabolic acidosis. I'd like you to tell me what the pH is. Normal, that's what you get. Does that mean you're fully compensated? Oh, no. It means you got two blood gas disorders at once. The one they like for you guys for part one, the one for endotoxic shocks part two is salicylate intoxication. Salicylates also overstimulate your respiratory center. So what's that one teaspoon of, please? respiratory alkalosis, right? And salicylic acid is what aspirin is, guys. And so it's an acid. You're adding an acid to the body. So what's that one teaspoon of? Metabolic acidosis. So what should your pH be? Normal. There you go. Now, you don't have to get into the big deal about kids with salicylate intoxication versus adults. Now, I know that those of you that are pediatricians know that they go through the respiratory alkalosis phase very quickly, and they end up making profound metabolic acidosis. I know that. And the boards doesn't make that distinction. Usually you see it in adults. Usually rheumatoids that are basically borderline or actually overtly toxic. They have tinnitus, all the signs of salicylate intoxication. You know, they're the ones that usually have that mixed disorder. But if you figure out that they have salicylate intoxication, you're looking for mixed disorder. So look for the normal pH. I'll show it to you. Don't worry. Don't worry. I'll show you what it looks like. All right. So we're done with respiratory center. Now, I don't know of any cause of respiratory alkalosis from an upper airway thing. Okay, how about this? Let's see how good you are. Got a kid 6 years old who has inspiratory stridor. Okay, first step in management, crash cart. And then you carefully bring the kid down to x-ray, you do a lateral x-ray, and you see the thumbprint sign, you have a swollen epiglottis diagnosis. Acute epiglottitis organism, please. H. influenza, okay? Is it still markedly increased in kids? No. The vaccination has decreased it immensely. See, that's why H. influenza meningitis is no longer even close to being the most common meningitis in kids anymore. Most common one depends on age. If you go over from 1 month to 18 years of age, it's Neisseria meningitis is the most common. H. influenza is way down the list, unless the kid did not get vaccinated. So we don't see that anymore. Now let's make it a three-month-old. Now what? Croup, laryngotracheal bronchitis organism, parainfluenza. You do a lateral x-ray, steeple sign. In fact, they asked on part one, where is the obstruction in croup? Answer, trachea. It's not at the level of the larynx, it's below it. It's swollen. That's part one. I thought that was pretty interesting. Then there's a Cathay coronary. That's the dude that's at a buffet usually. And usually hunched over their food with their eyes staring at the buffet line while they're shoving food into their mouth, worried that the shrimp are going to be gone. Okay? It's all... What do you do? Call a doctor. Okay? You're going to get what? Heimlich. Okay? Heimlich. And what are you going to do? Pointing towards their table, by the way. Okay? Because you don't want that big gob of crap to come out on your table. Okay? You're going to be a hero with everybody else. You're so wonderful. You're so perfect. But everyone at your table is going to be looking at you, you jerk. Why did you do it? Went right in my damn soup. Okay? Now, what if they can talk? What do? Leave them alone. Because they're partially obstructed, let them cough it out. If they can't talk, full obstruction. That's part two. Okay, so that's called Cathay coronary. All right. Chest bellows. Well, I can think of all kinds of things that can screw up my diaphragm because it's innervated by the fourth nerve, which is the phrenic nerve. So I can make it a Herb Duchenne palsy on a kid that's delivered by a breech. And there's a brachial plexus injury, and the kid's having respiratory difficulty. Chest x-ray reveals the diaphragm on the right side elevated. Well, if you paralyze the diaphragm, you're going to be able to retain, what are you going to do to CO2? Retain it, okay? Because of that. I can think of these horrible diseases, like Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. That's how you usually die, because your lower motor neurons are gone, and so are your upper motor neurons, and you can't breathe. Because your diaphragms are paralyzed, your intercostals are paralyzed, and you're going to die. I can think of Guillain-Barré, favorite board question. You have an ascending paralysis in someone 1 week ago that had an upper respiratory infection. Now they're getting a paralysis. Spinal fluid shows increased spinal fluid protein, a slight increase in lymphocytes, gram stain negative. Diagnosis, Guillain-Barré, a demyelinating disease. Okay, that can do it. Polio. Poliovirus, as you know, destroys lower motor neuron, upper motor neuron things. That could do it. So things that paralyze the muscles of respiration produce respiratory acidosis. I can't think of anything for respiratory alkalosis that would deal with that. Then, of course, lungs, obstructive lung disease, restrictive lung disease. You did have respiratory lectures by an expert on that who actually runs a lab for pulmonary function tests, for crying out loud. That's PASO. And so you learned obstructive lung disease is not a problem with getting air in, it was a problem in getting air out. Compliance increased, elasticity decreased. You remember that. So you're retaining CO2. So what do you usually have in obstructive lung disease? Respiratory acidosis. As opposed to restrictive lung disease, like sarcoid, pneumoconiosis.